You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Everyone these days could use a little support, and your friends at the ESO Network are no different. With the ESO Network Patreon, the cool thing is when you help support us, it's you who will benefit. With four tiers starting for as little as 25 cents a week, you can listen to some of your favorite network podcasts early, hear exclusive content, maybe get some ESO swag, or even possibly take a shot at the geek seat. All you need to do is sign up at patreon.com/ESO Network.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 253 of the Earth Station DCU. Tonight we're going to talk Batman the Adventures Continue Season 2 Number 3, Batman Urban Legends Number 6, Batman 89 Number 1, Future State Gotham Number 4, Justice League Last Ride Number 4, Rorschach Number 11, The Joker Number 6, I Am Batman Number 0, Detective Comics 1041, Wonder Woman 777, Infinite Frontier Number 4, Superman and Lois, Season 1, Episode 14, The Eradicator, Stargirl, Season 2, Episode 1, Summer School, Chapter 1, DC Legends of Tomorrow, Season 6, Episode 11, The Final Frame, and Sweet Tooth, Season 1, Episode 6, Stranger Danger on a Train. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. All right, Cletus, first up for DC news. Batman is about to leave Gotham, setting up his next major event. Following this fall's Fear State event, Bruce Wayne will leave Gotham City with the Bat family, defending the city while he's gone. Batman, Detective Comics, Batman Urban Legends all indicate that this absence will be around for a little while. The void left by Bruce Wayne's absence will build into next year's Shadows of the Bat event in Detective Comics.
Not terribly surprising that they're doing that. I mean, you know, we know that they're trying to push Jace as the next Batman, and it's hard to do if Bruce is still doing his thing.
That's very true. And I wonder if we're going to be seeing the Bat family working with Jace Fox.
I would hope so. I'd have to imagine. That'd be surprising if they kept it completely separate, but you never know. I know one thing I saw that was being advertised in the comics you read this week, Drew, that I'm curious. I don't know if it's meant to be a continuity thing or if it's just meant to be like a, you know, just a good Batman story thing. But they're doing another Batman International thing. And they've got different, like, international teams doing different stories within that. So I feel like it's possible that that gets incorporated to Batman's sabbatical, or it's possible, again, that that's just its own, you know, standalone story.
I bet it's part of the Batman sabbatical. Since he's supposed to be gone from Gotham,
It would make sense, right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
All right, up next for DC News, there's a Black Canary spinoff in development for HBO Max. I think this is a movie.
That's definitely what the indication seemed to be. Because they, and remember that they had talked about that they wanted to put out, obviously, movies, shows on HBO Max spinning out from those movies, but also then originals for HBO Max films, that is. So this feels like this would fall. It seemed from the article like this was falling into the third category. I mean, either way, you know, miniseries or movie, it's cool. I was a little bit surprised in a good way, because I wasn't sure how the studio felt about Birds of Prey. I mean, I know you and I really liked it, and critically, it was very well received. It didn't necessarily do as well as I think we're conditioned to superhero movies doing, especially Marvel films, just like, you know what I mean? Like, they always just make globs of money at the box office, and when a superhero movie doesn't do that, it's interesting whether studios who don't really particularly care if it's good or not, if they think it's a success if it's not making Marvel money. So this was good. I mean, I was encouraged. This was a very pleasant surprise. It was like, oh, they, you know, I think they saw that there was something to that movie. It was quite good. I still think it's one of DC's better films. So I'm glad that they haven't completely just dropped everything that they did with that.
Yeah, me too. All right, well, that wraps up our DC news for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
The kid and I have flown from one side of the galaxy to the other. We've been listening to a lot of strange podcasts, but the Monster Sci-Fi Show stands above the rest. Isn't that right, Grogu? I still hate that name.
The Monster Sci-Fi Show is part of the ESO Network. It's sci-fi from a certain point of view.
And we're back! But before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know, there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers!
Spoilers!
Spoilers! We got spoilers!
Spoilers
for you! We got spoilers!
Spoilers,
spoilers,
we've
got spoilers,
spoilers
for you.
All right, let's talk Batman. The adventures continue. Season 2, number 3. Batman was supposed to team up with Batgirl and then cancels. Batgirl is pissed when she finds out that he went out without her. Batman is trying to find Jimmy the Jazzman Peak because he has information that can take down Black Mask. Batgirl's after the Jazzman because he shot her father, Commissioner Gordon. Batman tells Batgirl she's too close to the case and to go home. Batgirl has a talk with Jazzman's ex-girlfriend. After a little coaxing from Batgirl, she tells Batgirl to check out Zig Tats. He's the only one that Jazzman would be seeing from the old days. Now, Batgirl tracks down Jazzman at a tattoo parlor. Batgirl is able to take him in when the Huntress shows up. Huntress wants revenge on Jazzman for helping to kill her family. Batgirl tries to reason with Huntress, but she's too dead set on revenge. The two women fight until Jazzman's posse show up, and then Batgirl and Huntress work together to take out the bad guys. Batgirl saves Huntress after she gets whacked in the back of the head by Jazzman, and Huntress states she owes Batgirl one and lets her take Jazzman in. When Jazzman is questioned, Batman and Batgirl are in the interrogation room. Batman discovers a micro dot with information on Black Mask mob hidden on one of his tattoos. Jazzman is handed over to a prison guard who escorts Jazzman to his cell. It's the Huntress in disguise, and she gets her revenge.
This was pretty good. I was surprised how standalone this one felt, just considering what we've seen with most of this series. I feel like generally the stories have kind of strung together. I enjoyed it. The only thing that was a little surprising to me, Drew, not shocking with their characterization of Batgirl potentially being okay with Jazzman being offed by Huntress, but it felt like, not that Batman was okay with it, but he was either okay with it or oblivious to it, and neither of those totally makes sense.
Yeah, I know where you're coming at. I mean, I'm used to Batman in the comics. Him and Huntress, he usually has a problem with Huntress because she has no problem killing. So that's usually where they butt heads at. But we didn't really see that here, did we?
Well, they hint at it. Barbara says something to someone. I'm pretty sure she's just narrating out loud for the audience, but I think she actually says it to Jazzman, which is kind of weird, but she mentions that, you know, Huntress and Batman don't work well together for that exact reason. But Batman's aware that Huntress is on the scene. It just seemed, I didn't really mind. It's not necessarily that, I guess, you know, he couldn't have stopped her ultimately anyway if she really wanted to, but it was odd how like removed from that situation he was.
Yeah, that's true. When I started reading this, I was trying to remember back to the last issue because I didn't remember this leading into this. But when you said it was a standalone story, I was like, okay, that makes sense. But I could not remember what happened in the issue before.
It was the end of or at least seeming end of the Court of Owls story.
Oh, okay. For some reason, it felt like I should have known what was going on and going into the story, but that definitely makes it stand alone.
Yeah. And we think, or maybe hope, that they're going to do more with that Court of Owls, because that ended up being unfulfilling, I would say. And I'm wondering if this is just them filling time before they swing back to it. So you kind of feel as the reader as though they like are resurfacing, or if they're just slowly transitioning to a new story. I don't know. I think it kind of remains to be seen what they plan to do.
The other thing is they could be introducing Batgirl and Huntress, because they're going to be in the Court of Owls story in the future too. But I have a feeling we're not going to be going back to the Court of Owls story next time either. I have a feeling we're going to have something else first.
So yeah, I would agree with that.
And who knows? Maybe they'll be bringing more of the Bat family in. I have a feeling the Bat family is going to be helping with the Court of Owls in the future. At least that's what my gut tells me.
I just hope that they're not done completely with it, because it just wasn't enough. It wasn't necessarily that it was bad. It just wasn't enough. If that's what you're going to do for the Court of Owls, then just don't do it. So I'm hoping that there's more to it. I don't whether that involves the Bat family or just Batman, regardless, they just need to do more.
I agree. All right, let's move on to our next title for this week. Batman Urban Legends number 6. The first story is Red Hood and Batman in Cheer, part 6 of 6. Jason Todd, with the help of Oracle, breaks into the garage. Jason grabs the only antidote for cheer drops and borrows a bat suit that can protect against Mr. Freeze's weapon. Red Hood goes up against Mr. Freeze and beats him. Cheer gasses Jason with his cheer gas. As Jason fights against the drug, the Bat family show up thanks to Oracle. Nightwing, Batwoman, Orphan, Spoiler, and the Signal. Tim Drake went to the hospital to protect the mother of the boy that Red Hood befriended a few issues ago. Now, the Wayne Foundation puts the mother and her son, Tyler, in a home, and Jason gives the boy his own blue hood costume. Bruce and Jason have a conversation. Jason tells Bruce that he's giving up the guns. He's been using rubber bullets lately anyways, but none of it feels okay now. Then he tells Bruce that he still thinks some people should die, and those people, I still want to hurt them. He just doesn't want to hurt anyone else. Now, Jason and Bruce shake hands and Jason leaves. Bruce calls after Jason and tells him that life is too short for us to be like this. Oh, Jason closes his motorcycle helmet visor and rides off into the sunset. Leslie says that Bruce seems off, and she asks him what the gas showed him, and Bruce answers, happiness. Now, the story ends with Bruce's vision. The Red Hood brings Batman the Joker, and Batman chokes the Joker to death, and Jason thanks him. The whole Bat family is there, and they are happy.
I was pretty pleased with the conclusion of this story, Drew. I thought that he wrapped it up well. No real complaints, honestly, for me. This was a good story all around.
Yeah, I liked it too. I like the fact that it sort of buried the hatchet between Red Hood and Batman. Not totally, but somewhat.
I feel like the hatchet's buried as much as it can when you have two emotionally stunted men like Jason Todd and Bruce Wayne.
Well, I thought that was odd that they were moving with him giving up the guns. I wonder if this is going to last or not.
Probably not, but yeah, I don't know. I think the problem with something like that is it kind of depends on the writer that gets them.
Yeah, I totally agree, because I could see a writer coming on and be like, he needs to have his guns. We're bringing them back. Yeah, I could see them doing that easily. Jason is a anti-hero, so I could totally see them bringing back the guns.
Well, I mean, like for instance, we know he's using them in the Suicide Squad story, but that also doesn't seem to be a continuity story. So I think it just depends on what we get, like on the writer that we get.
Yeah, I agree. All right, the next story we get is Z-Lot in Blood for Blood. Months ago, At Charis Towers in Gateway City, the assassin Zealot goes after Maxwell Lord, dressed as Wonder Woman. Maxwell Lord is able to escape out the window via helicopter. 6 days later, in Kodor, Montenegro, Zealot shows up on the beach to kill Maxwell Lord once again. Wonder Woman is there to stop her. Wonder Woman calls her Zana, and they have met before. As Wonder Woman and Zealot fight each other, Maxwell Lord gets away on a boat. Now, during the fight, Zealot cuts Wonder Woman's arm with her sword. And after Wonder Woman leaves, Zealot puts some of Wonder Woman's blood on her face like war paint. And then she puts some of Wonder Woman's blood in a vial. Then she states she got what she came for and is heading back to Gotham. Okay, I am not sure who this Zealot character is, or if I've seen them before, but I'm guessing they had ties to Batman somehow, because this was a weird story to have.
This is connected to that Wildcats team that was Jim Lee's Image property.
Oh, okay.
So I know nothing, absolutely nothing about her, because I've read zero comics with those guys. So I don't really have an opinion on the story, to be honest with you, Drew, because I didn't really get what was... Like, I got the action, but the blood thing didn't totally make sense to me. But I'm pretty sure if I knew that character, that would have made sense to me. So I can't really critique it from that perspective. That was one of those things, like, I felt like if I knew that character, that story would have worked, but I don't. And so it was just totally lost on me.
So is this one of the characters that goes with Grifter then? Because we know...
Yeah, and she was in, I don't know if you remember, she was in towards the end of that Grifter story.
Yeah, I don't remember. but I do remember Grifter, his ultimate goal was getting, what was he getting, Coach the Bat Computer? Now we're getting Wonder Woman's blood. What are they up to?
Yeah, I have no idea. I have no idea.
And I don't care enough to read their story, so. All right, well, let's move on to our next story. It's Tim Drake in Some of Our Parts, Part 3 of 3. Tim Drake discovers that the Chaos Monsters are sacrificing teens. Bernard is next. Robin uses smoke pellets and rescues Bernard. He tells Bernard to get out of here, but Bernard refuses. He's a big fan of Robin and has been training, and Robin and Bernard fight together against the Chaos Monsters. Now, during the police cleanup, Robin talks to his new detective friend. Robin tells him he broke up with his girlfriend, who he loves for no reason. The detective tells him, I know what you're going through because I've been through it too. You're holding too tight to a version of yourself you think you have to fit. Let go. You can figure out what you want along the way. And when Tim goes to see Bernard, Bernard asks him on a date, and Tim says yes. And this is to be continued in Batman Urban Legends number 10, which is 4 issues from now. I was like, dang, why are we waiting so long to tell the rest of this story?
I don't think it's the rest of the story. I think they're just continuing Tim's story, like his, you know, self-discovery story next in issue 10.
You're right about this story.
I told you. I was the when I read this story and I was getting that feeling. I was like, man, I think I'm right. And then sure enough, there it was. I was like, oh, I was right.
I was so mad the day this issue came out. Because the news, the comic news spoiled it. I saw it all over the place. I'm like, really, guys? Come on. It's not even, I know they're making a big, huge deal out of it, but this is a small story, big issue, and you have to spoil it all over the place.
What's interesting to me, Drew, also in the coverage of this story is a lot of them are labeling Tim as coming out as bisexual in this story. I'm not sure that that's true. I mean, he certainly does not say that at any point in the story. I don't know that that's what they're going to go with. I don't know. It feels like they're trying to come into a middle ground to kind of come to terms with his past with Stephanie Brown with this new status quo. I don't know. I think it obviously remains to be seen by with what the writers choose to do with his character, but I don't know that they're going to just stop it bisexual, if I'm being honest with you.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, because I thought the same thing when I read it, because I saw all those news articles. They were saying it's bisexual. I'm like, are you guys sure? Because I didn't get that out of reading this.
No, I got a much stronger message than that, which is fine. I mean, they can go in whatever direction they want. I was just, those articles felt like they were trying to give an answer themselves, because the comic technically doesn't give one, but I don't know. I thought it made it fairly clear to me, at least.
I would still like to see the story where he breaks up with Spoiler. And I guess I could see, because they wanted to keep this, I guess, secret until the reveal here, why they didn't show that story before. But I kind of would like to see that story and see how that conversation goes. Because I'm curious what Spoiler thinks about what's going on and how she feels and stuff.
One thing I would say to that, Drew, is I don't know that the breakup story would have a lot of this, because it's implied that he doesn't really know either at that point. You know, like he breaks up with her for reasons. He feels discontent with his life, something, but he doesn't really have something to put the words to it. So I don't know that it would be. I think you could make an interesting, conversation out of it, but it might not be one of those ones that's not that interesting, because he doesn't really know what's wrong either at that point.
That's true. But anyways, I was mad at the comic news, but I was happy to get the part of the story. So, and I'm curious to see what's going to happen next. It feels like to me that they're trying to make Bernard, what I want to say, another vigilante or another sidekick or somebody else who's coming into the Bat family. That's what it felt like to me. So it remains to see what they're going to do with Bernard.
Yeah, it's interesting. It almost feels like they felt some sort of need to justify the romantic interest. Like he couldn't just be interested in a guy that lives a normal life. You know, it was interesting. So it's like, and they do the same thing with female love interest from time to time too. But I feel like they're less apologetic with that. So I found that kind of interesting. It felt like they were trying to justify Tim hanging around him. It was like, but he could just be interested in him. Clearly he is.
Well, I'm going to point out the fact that they did that with Spoiler.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're absolutely right. So part of me wonders if that's intentional, if they're trying to mirror what happened with Stephanie in that regard. I don't know.
That's very possible.
I don't mind. I mean, it's whatever. I mean, sure. If you want to include him, in the crime fighting, I guess it's a little unbelievable, but sure.
All right, well, let's move on to our next story. Black Canary in Solo. Black Canary and Green Arrow are practicing shooting at a picture of Batman's head on top of the Hall of Justice. Dinah gets a call from Oracle and puts on a classic Batman disappearing act on Ollie, right after she suggests getting it on, too. Found that hilarious. Oracle tells Dinah that after the Joker's attack on Gotham, every Batman vehicle and piece of technology the Joker stole was sold before they could get it back. And the buyers were a British company called Trust, which stands for Transparent Researchers United for Strategy and Technology. Now, Trust is run by a woman named Juliette Ballantyne. Oracle wants Black Canary to go undercover as herself. So Black Canary goes to a party and saves Juliette Ballantyne from an assassination attempt. Juliet tells Dinah that Trust is a new front for something older, something that her parents believed in and would join them from time to time. Black Canary learns she is going to be working with a partner she's worked with in the past, and she thinks it might be Ollie, but it ends up being Deathstroke. Now, in the epilogue, we learn that Juliet Ballantyne wanted the assassins to attack her, assassins that came from Lady Talia, and Talia states that a shadow war is coming. Now, I got to tell you, Cletus, I found this story very interesting. And I'm very curious what is going on here.
Yeah, the sort of headline at the end, the Deathstroke Inc., obviously, I think intentionally reminiscent of Batman Inc. kind of interesting. Are they setting up an international Deathstroke squad?
I thought I remembered them hinting at Deathstroke Inc. before. And that possibly,
yeah, I think you're right.
And I think possibly Red Hood was supposed to be part of it.
I can't remember that, but I think you're right. It does sound like a familiar idea that they were teasing. It's interesting. I am interested in this. One thing I think is also, I don't know what the other, I keep using the word interesting, but Black Canary, we already see that she's a part of this secret organization with Checkmate, and now they've got her in what's ever going on with this. It's kind of interesting, I guess, that they're using her in so much of their kind of secret ops stuff. It's not that it's a pretty good fit, in my opinion. It's just not, I guess, the character I would have thought of right away.
The other thing I've been wondering is, with Black Canary working with Oracle again, are they going to be putting together the Birds of Prey again?
I think that's almost a guarantee.
Now, the original Birds of Prey was Oracle, Black Canary, and Huntress. And I remember when they first kicked off that comic way back in the 90s. So I used to collect that comic. It was pretty good. So I wouldn't mind the team coming back together.
I'm pretty confident you're going to get what you want, Drew. I would be honestly shocked.
So, but yeah, this story, I really enjoyed this story. I'm excited about seeing more of it. Let's move on to our next title for this week. Batman 89, number one. Gotham City, October 31st. Harvey Dent is on a date with Barbara Gordon. Harvey proposes to her, and he gives her a coin and says, heads is yes and tails is no. And Barbara points out the fact that it's a two-headed coin. Gotham City is having its annual Halloween celebration. We see that Joker's men have planned an armored truck heist, and Batman is able to foil it. When they try to shoot him, he uses a giant penny as a shield from the bullets. Now, Barbara gets her purse stolen, and Harvey chases down the clown. He pulls a gun on them and then flips a coin. Heads they die, tails they walk. Harvey fired off a warning shot to scare them. When Alfred wakes Bruce up the next day, Harvey Dent is downstairs. Harvey wants Bruce to back him. He's going to take down Batman. Harvey thinks Batman is Jim Gordon's personal hit squad, well-trained and well-funded. Harvey calls in the National Guard, and also Batman's tech is being analyzed, such as his Batarang, which is a cross between a boomerang and a throwing star, and it has a computerized targeting system. The Reverend Cecil Culp of the Gotham City Congregational Church is asking the Gotham City Council for a vote of no confidence in Commissioner James Gordon. The bat signal is up, but it's not Commissioner Gordon. It's Harvey Dent and Harvey Bullock, who have a trap set for Batman. Three snipers in nearby buildings. There's a robbery that gets Batman's attention, and Batman finds a kid with a baby. Batman asks where his mother is and is told on the fire escape. Batman gets a boot in the face and then knocked off the fire escape. He saves himself with a grappling hook, but he lands right in front of the National Guard.
Pretty good first issue, Drew, I thought. One thing I guess I have to ask you, because I don't know that this is necessarily a complaint because I don't remember well enough. My memory of the Batman 66 series is that Batman was drawn to look like Adam West. Am I remembering right? Obviously,
yes.
I know it was meant to be that, but like he was actually like the facial features looked like him. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, I don't know if they were allowed to do that. I could see that being the case, but if they were trying, they didn't succeed. So again, I don't know that I can criticize because I don't know what their options were, but not the best impression.
Now, I've been looking. I love the Batman 89 movie. I mean, it came out when I was a freshman in high school, and we hadn't had any live Batman stuff since the Batman 66 stuff. So I was very excited when this came out. I love this movie. And I was I've been looking forward to this comic coming out. I actually tried to go pick up a hard copy of it, and I couldn't find it anywhere. It's sold out. I even tried to order it online from Midtown Comics in New York. They were out of it, too. It surprised me that it was sold out like that. I guess I didn't expect it to be as popular as it is, I guess.
I mean, that's certainly good. I wonder how much they printed. I wonder if it was as heavily printed as some of their other books, but regardless, selling out is good. So that's a good sign.
Yeah, but I was bummed I couldn't get a copy of it.
Yeah. Bad for you, but well, I'm sure the prospects of the series.
I'm sure they're going to reprint it, so I want to pick that up. And I got a buddy that really likes it. I'd like to pick up a copy for him, too. So, especially when his birthday's coming up soon. But, yeah, I really enjoyed the issue. And it kind of – I think one of the things I liked about it is, first of all, it immersed me back into that world. Plus, it's different from the Batman stuff we're getting in the comics. So, that was nice, too. All right, let's move on to our next title for this week. Future State Gotham number 4. The magistrate dispatches Hunter Panic to go after Punchline since Red Hood and Ravager are no longer in the game. Harley Quinn is going after Punchline. She finds Punchline at one of her safe houses, and Harley tells Punchline she's going to die tonight. Punchline injects her henchmen with the new Man Laugh Serum. It's a modification of Dr. Langstrom's formula, replacing the bat DNA with hyena DNA. Harley must battle against hyena men while Punchline gathers up her things. She's trying to leave town. Hunter Panic shows up and tells both Harley and Punchline she's taking them both down. Punchline blows up the house, and then Harley chases after Punchline after a brief fight, and Harley knocks out Punchline. Harley hands Punchline over to Hunter Panic, and Punchline yells at Harley, telling her she should have killed them both because the next Joker is coming. After I read this issue, I was like, why are we still reading this?
Oh, Drew, and the tease at the end was disheartening, so I was like, oh no, they want to do more? There's just so much I don't like about the Punchline character. And again, it really, a lot of it comes down to being told how much I'm supposed to like her and how highly I'm supposed to think of her. And it's just that automatically puts me in a mindset where I'm not going to be in the character you're trying to pitch to me. And we get it again in this issue where they're like, oh, going after Punchline, you can't do that. That's an A-lister. I'm like, come on. Come on, guys.
I thought the same thing. We also had a backup story in this. Batman battles a bunch of Joker clown henchmen over a case with the Joker's face on it. And when the case explodes, the henchmen are surprised that the Joker had them guarding a bomb. Batman replies, "The Joker will sacrifice anyone to destroy me."
This was good. If memory serves correctly, it's the same artist that did the last backup, and these have been really good. I've very much enjoyed them.
Yeah, and the thing I liked about it was, yeah, the Joker would have you guard a bomb set to, you know, try to blow up Batman. So that's not unusual.
Oh yeah.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week: Justice League Last Ride number 4. This is the before story. Batman and Martian Manhunter are trying to figure out how to shut down the nukes before Darkseid's army shows up. Martian Manhunter fights off Calibic, while Batman locates Apocalypse's main power source and overrides its failsafes. Martian Manhunter decides to tear through the safety hatch to drain it. Superman objects, stating he will do it, but Batman doesn't think Superman can get there in time. Martian Manhunter decides to sacrifice himself to stop the nukes. Now we're back in the present. John Stewart and Wonder Woman try to use diplomacy to stop the ships heading to Apocalypse to destroy Lobo. It doesn't work, so they try to disable the ships. Batman and Hal Jordan try to activate Apocalypse's defenses without the planet's power, since Hal Jordan is basically a walking power battery. Mongol shows up in space and battles against Wonder Woman. Lobo tells Superman and Flash he didn't kill the New Gods, and Flash wonders who killed the New Gods if it wasn't Lobo. Flash states it feels like a trap. On the horizon, Superman sees an army coming towards him. Manhunters led by none other than Cyborg Superman.
Cyborg Superman, that seemed like a combo with Brainiac, too.
Why'd you think it was a combo?
Am I not remembering the comic right? I'm almost positive it was like a Superman. It was like a...
I don't remember him being green. Let me bring it up, too.
I'm pulling it up. Maybe I'm misremembering. I don't think I am, though. Oh, no, it definitely is. It's for sure, yeah. 100% a Cyborg / Brainiac combo.
Oh, I see it now.
Pretty sure. I don't remember thinking that was that inconspicuous. Which is interesting. That's an interesting comic. Honestly, when I saw that, Drew, I was like, I'm surprised that's not popped up before. That just seems like a really logical combo.
Yeah, it does. An even more powerful Cyborg.
I don't think it's a coincidence that this was my favorite issue of this series so far, because it was the one that I finally felt like I understood the story. Not that it was confusingly told, but we were missing information in the first issues. Like, we were getting hints, and we had kind of a light understanding of stuff that had happened. But this was the issue that finally was like, here's really what happened that everybody's all worked up about in the present, understandably so. And they developed more of what's going on. Like, I felt more stakes in what was going on with Lobo as well in the present. Just both the past and present stories, I thought, were much more developed, came into a more clear focus of what the, you know, what they're doing with those. And like I said, not a coincidence, it was my favorite issue of the series.
Yeah, I agree with you. I enjoyed this one as well. And I thought it made it clear what was going on, too. I found it interesting that Hal Jordan's like a power battery. I'm wondering if that's going to be continued over into the Green Lantern title and why he still has able to use Green Lantern energy.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely still time for more answers for things like that, but I thought this one was good at least giving some, I thought, answers that we needed, frankly, earlier. Like, again, I want to give a lot of credit to this issue for bringing the story into focus, but I do think some of this could have been done earlier. Because I think I would have appreciated the story more. Like, I retroactively appreciate some of the stuff I saw in previous issues thanks to the context that I have now. But I just... And we talk about this with some of the shows, too. I question the decision that so many people seem to be using where they kind of flash ahead and then jump back to the story. I'm like, well, but sometimes just build up to it. Just give me the context.
Yeah, you already know how I feel about that. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Rorschach number 11. The detective has been drinking and is having an imaginary conversation with the cowgirl. He knows Alan has been lying to him, and this was all a setup to get Redford discredited and Turley elected. Alan has set up a meeting with Turley so the detective can go over the whole case with him. From the imaginary conversation that the detective had with Cowgirl, is he becoming the new Rorschach? Is he going to kill Turley? Seems like it, especially when we come to the last panel and the detective says, "Hmm."
That last line, I just, again, it's one of the things I appreciate that King is able to do. Where not, I mean, he can be verbose in his writing sometimes, but also he can communicate things so well. Sometimes he just trusts the artist to tell the story for him. Or in that, we get a singular word, but it communicates so much, right? Like, we know instantly what's going on with the detective in that moment.
Did it feel weird to you that this issue, that we've seen the detective, I guess what felt weird to me in this issue was the detective seemed like he was, had his head on straight up till we get to this issue. Then I'm questioning his sanity now. why is all of a sudden he turning into... basically Rorschach?
I don't think we're done getting answers next time issue, so I don't want to speculate too much. I'm not convinced that King has given us the full picture just yet, so there might be some stuff with the detective that we don't know. But it also, I mean, in one sense, I feel like it's kind of made sense. He's been living in these people's minds and world for the last 11 issues, right? Like, part of it, like how good he is at doing this is how he's figured out, you know, what's been going on. But when you let the crazy live in your head like that, I don't know, you can kind of see how it would happen.
Yeah. And it felt like we saw him kind of arguing with Cowgirl in his head that she wants him to become the next Rorschach. And we see him basically debating it with himself the whole time. And that last panel there makes you wonder, is he going to go through with it or not? I like how King left it. And, of course, the next issue is the last issue, so it's going to wrap everything up. So I'm excited about that.
Yeah, and what another great issue and just an unbelievably good series. The reveals that we get in this one, where we had kind of, again, we had already pieced together what the plot was, right? And now when we had kind of gotten a hint that the guy that hired the detective was in on it, and we get a fuller answer to that here. And again, we get a little bit more of the curtain peeled back where, yes, this was the plan, but this plan wasn't actually intended to work. And then when the guy went to visit and realized, oh, she actually is that good of a shot, all of a sudden everything kind of went haywire because they were just supposed to be a couple of crazies with no shot to succeed. And then all of a sudden they, you know, had he not seen that, they would have probably succeeded.
Yeah. I mean, if he hadn't injured Cowgirl's arm, she probably would have made that shot that we saw in the first issue. So all very interesting.
Oh, it's just so good. I mean, this has just been an amazing, amazing series. I'm a huge fan of it.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. The Joker number 6. Hooper County, Texas, 50 years ago. Two brothers are hunting a blonde girl who is trying to escape. The brothers are trying to catch her so they can eat her for dinner. Chasing her through the swamp, they come across Texas tea. Oil. In the present, we see a newspaper article that states the Sampson family finds millions in own backyard. Massacre victim recants testimony, points finger at youngest Sampson. DA suspects payoff. Billy the Brute Sampson's transferred to Arkham Asylum. Jim Gordon is in Paris searching for the Joker. Barbara is trying to research and get intel on both Lady Bane and the Sampsons. Barbara also tells Jim that Cressida, the woman who hired him, has been living the most boring life, and she has no additional information on her. We see that Gordon hires Private Eye Harvey Bullock to help him on the case. Interpol shows up to arrest Jim Gordon because his fingerprints were all over a murder scene at a private laboratory, Montmartre, courtesy of the Joker. I think one of the most surprising things about this series was the fact it wasn't... We found out it was going on like 14 issues. And when I read this issue, I got the feeling this was going to be, I could tell it was going to be stretched out a lot more than just a mini series from this.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. I think one of the things that illustrates that is that I feel when you look relatively at what we've gotten in the series so far, it's just kind of been spinning its wheels. It's not really done a lot. I mean, stuff has happened. But I feel like the most complete stories we've gotten so far have been the like standalone flashback stories.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. It has been spinning its wheels, sort of. Like you said, there's stuff that's going on, but it is spinning its wheels a little bit. And stuff's not moving forward like I would expect.
It's one thing that's interesting to me is how much it just seems like an introspective piece on Jim Gordon, which is fine. I have no complaints there. But it is a series called The Joker, and it just seems to be more of a character study than an actual, you know, plot-driven vehicle.
Yeah, and calling it The Joker, this is a Jim Gordon story, not really a Joker story. The Joker's in it, but we haven't even seen him that much. It's definitely been focused on Jim Gordon, his history, and like you said, a character-driven. So, yeah. We also had a backup punchline story. Well, we have in each one of these. We see that Harper Rowe goes undercover as Catherine Skinner. She goes to jail to get evidence against Punchline to put her away forever. Harper tries to stay hidden and eat by herself, but Punchline calls her over to sit with her. Punchline knows she's Harper Rowe. Then Punchline tricks Harper into hitting her. And Punchline has the video uploaded to gain support from her followers. Then Punchline wants Harper Rowe dead after she leads them to Kelly Ness. I continue not to be impressed by this story.
I mean, it's just the way they bend over backwards constantly to make Punchline always be like 20 steps ahead. And a character like Harper Rowe, who's an intelligent hero, been portrayed in other stories, it's just it, like her plan immediately blows up, Drew. Immediately. It doesn't work for even 1 second. Like, it's like they put that in there just for you know, Punchline to once again have her plan just succeed at every turn. Literally everything she sets up, convincing Harper Rowe to infiltrate the prison. Come on, man. I mean, if she's really this just pure genius of a character, then what's she doing in jail? Why has Lex not recruited her to lead the Injustice League? Not even just be a member. I mean, clearly she's the greatest person to have ever crimed in their life. So, you know, I don't get it, Drew. Maybe even Darkseid could, like, you know, ask to be her assistant. I don't know. Where do we want to stop with her?
Oh man, yeah, I know exactly what you mean. All right,
does she tutor the Annie monitor on the side? You know, like.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. I am Batman number 0. When the issue opens up, we get a flashback scene to where we learn that Tim Fox was trained by Katana and took on the name Jace as his war name. Now in the present, Jace is moving out of his parents' house to get his own place. He tells his parents he needs some breathing room, but in reality it's so he can continue his new missions at night without questions. Commissioner Montoya is not happy when a riot is started by her own men when the demonstrators had a permit. People may hate cops, but cops don't hate people. Montoya puts Whitaker and his partner in charge of the next demonstration in Alleytown. Jace runs into Hadia, who is in Gotham on business. She's going to be in town until Friday. Fall tells Jace that the 6 IDs Tyler Arkadine's courier was transporting, at least one of the radicals is in Gotham. Jace puts on a generic mask and gloves and takes off on his motorcycle. Jace tracks the radical to a warehouse in the Gotham shipyards that's supposed to be abandoned. He discovers they are working with explosives. Further searching turns up 6 dead radical bodies. It is discovered that it was supposed to look like an accidental explosion. Jace figures out that Arkadine hired professional hitters so that they could fake like they were radicals and start some trouble. Vol brings in the bat suit and uses it to track weapons in the crowd. The magistrates show up and damage the bat armor. Jace sneaks out of the suit just in time and gets away. Jace meets up with Hadia in the park. She tells Jace to start being a young man who wants to make a difference. Now back at his lair, Jace tells Vol he needs help designing something new.
One thing, Drew, I'm interested and curious to see what they do. Are they going to call him Jace or are they going to call him Tim? They keep doing the both thing and it's just starting to get confusing at this point. Like, I know who they're talking about in either instance, but like, he tells one character, like, I go by Jace now. She's like, okay, Tim. I just like them to pick one.
I know what you mean, because it is getting old going back and forth.
I truly do not care which one they pick. It does not matter to me. I just would like if they picked one.
Same. I don't care which one they go with either. I just want to start calling him something consistently. This was a fine setup to what was going on. To me, it felt like a continuation of what we read before. But with it being a zero issue, I could tell it was more set up to, you know, going into the regular story. Because he hasn't actually put on the bat costume we've seen in the Future State Next Batman titles.
You have to assume that's pretty soon.
Well, I'm sure it'll be in issue number one. I guess we don't have anything more to say about it. All right, let's move on to our next title for this week. Detective Comics 1041. Mayor Nakano is being briefed about the infection that has 11 bodies in the morgue and 3 patients in the hospital. The mayor is also notified about the explosions in the sewer system. Hugh Vile is missing, plus Mr. Worth is causing problems with Bruce Wayne. Bruce talks to Oracle and tells her Mr. Worth and Penguin have teamed up to take out Batman and Bruce Wayne. They've left signs all over the city telling Batman to deliver Wayne from the jury. Batman takes the bait and makes his way to the jury. Penguin, Mr. Worth, and the Falcones. Batman tries to explain that Sarah Worth was killed by a man named Neil Betterman, but the jury will hear none of it. Worth orders their henchmen to fire on Batman. Earlier, the monster was taken from Hugh Vile and put into a tube. The vial is shot at Batman and he becomes infected by the monster. I honestly thought that was stupid. One, how'd they know that Hugh Vile was the monster? And how'd they know they could pull it out and shoot it at Batman? I don't know. I just thought it was stupid.
Well, what I think is dumb is they're not fully explaining that part of the plot. Is Penguin the one that's got a hold of Vile, but Worth doesn't know? Because if Worth knows, Worth would have to know that he's the one actually responsible for the death of his daughter. You know what I mean? Like, I'm almost getting frustrated in the, like, just intense, superhuman level boneheadedness that he's displaying to just completely miss all of the signs screaming that he's on the wrong path. I know that that's the point, that he's supposed to be like so enraged that he's not listening to any reason, but he's literally working with the guys that are using the person that killed his daughter, and he's just completely unaware of that. I mean, he has to be, right? Like, he has to be just completely unaware.
Yeah, he would have to be. Because if he knew that, he'd be going after them.
I would just like more detail, I guess, on the villain side of what's going on. Who's using Hugh exactly now? Like, is it Penguin? Is it somebody else who's also in cahoots with Penguin? It can't be Worth. And how are they keeping Worth in the dark? I want a little bit more. I continue to really like this story for the most part. I feel like they're leaving a few details out that they, I think, need to be included.
And I agree with you. We also had a backup story about Deb Donovan in this. Deb gets a note in her pocket while on the subway. Where are the corpses going? While investigating at the morgue, Deb discovers that Astrid Arkham's body is missing. Someone sticks a gun in Deb's back and tries to kill her for investigating the morgue story, but Batman saves her. Deb meets up with Vicki Vale to get some advice on her story. When Deb gets home, Red Hood is sitting in her apartment eating cereal. Red Hood says, "I see you got my note." It felt like the Red Hood thing was leading to some other story. Well, actually, I think if I remember right, it actually said that. I forget exactly what it said.
Yeah, it was Task Force Z, I think is what they called it.
Oh, that's right. It was Task Force Z. And I remember seeing something about Task Force Z in some other book recently. One of the things I found weird about this story was we saw Batman save her, but wouldn't you think it would have been the Red Hood that should have saved her or been keeping an eye on her instead of Batman?
For the sake of the story that we get, especially by the end, I don't know. I guess the problem is if it's Red Hood that does that, then you lose the reveal at the end. I don't know. Maybe if you have her be saved and she doesn't see who saves her, and so you assume it's Batman, and then you find out at the end it's Red Hood, that might have been the best way to go.
Yeah, I like that idea. I just thought it was weird that Batman saved her and not Red Hood, because you would think Red Hood would be keeping an eye on her, but whatever. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Wonder Woman 777. Wonder Woman is very excited to be back on Earth. She takes Siegfried and Ratatosk to the Hall of Justice to meet her friends. Diana comes across Miss Martian first, but quickly learns that she is Marcia and that this is Earth 11. Diana meets with the Justice Guild and explains who Janice is. Dead Man shows up and states that Janice is on Earth 11. Elsewhere on Earth 11, Janice frees a prisoner that wants revenge against the Justice League Guild, Dane of Elysium, otherwise known as Wonder Man. Wonder Man attacks the Hall of Justice and fails. Janice shows up and battles against Wonder Woman, and when Janice goes for the kill, Ratatosk bites her hand. The rest of the Justice League Guild attack. Diana tries to use the God Scepter against Janice, but it doesn't work. Janice takes Dead Man hostage and escapes through a portal. Diana, Siegfried, and Ratatosk follow Janice quickly before the portal vanishes. I gotta tell you, I don't know if you were, but I was surprised that it ended up being Earth 11. I wasn't expecting that, but I thought it was a nice twist. We were in the Godsphere, now we're starting to go through the multiverse. It was cool to see the Justice League Guild helping out Wonder Woman in this.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, again, just the series has been consistently great, and this was definitely no exception.
We also got a young Diana story in this. Diana runs into the palace of Themyscira and calls her mother a liar. Queen Hippolyta tells Diana of her sister Antiope. Themyscira was thriving. Boats arrived with men on board. They welcomed them as allies, but soon were disappointed and taken as prisoners. Hippolyta prayed to Athena and was heard. The Amazon's release came with one condition. Mercy would be shown to those who held them captive. One of the men thought he could have it all, Paradise Island and Antiope. He was a cruel and merciless barbarian who did not understand love. He would have ended Antiope's life if Hippolyta did not do something. That night, the rest of the army tried to escape and died by the Amazon's hand, and it all started with a single spear thrown by Queen Hippolyta, and it's to be continued. I don't know about you, Cletus, but I don't think they did a good enough job of telling the story about the men coming and stuff, because I found it a little confusing.
I mean, we all know, I think most people know the classic Hercules or Heracles Amazonian myth and how that ties into the DC version of the Amazons. But I thought that they were going to do something more, and then they just were sort of like, it felt like the reveal was that it was the, you know, Heracles taking the Amazonians captive. And I was like, yeah, but I mean, that's not new. You know what I mean? It was like, that might, I guess, possibly be new to Diana, but that's not new information to most readers. Honestly, I would argue even younger kids, because Greek mythology is pretty popular, Drew. You know, so I don't know. I agree with you. There's got to be something more missing from the answer so far, because that was a little, I don't know, not enough.
Yeah, I agree. It wasn't enough. And maybe we'll get more next issue. But I don't know. I think they told it a little weird. So, but I guess we'll find out next issue. All right, let's move on to our last title for this week. Infinite Frontier number 4. President Superman and Thomas Wayne are becoming fast friends. Thomas is impressed that Ellis has turned his Oval Office into the Fortress of Solitude and that he secretly keeps tabs on his parents. Ellis tracks down Lex Luthor of Earth 23, and Lex is dead. Bones has Alan Scott and Obsidian as prisoners. Bones tells Agent Chase he's cut a deal that will keep their Earth safe. Jade, Wildcat, Atom Smasher, Power Girl, and some other JSA members find Black Lantern Roy Harper. They are trapped in the Bleed. That is until Hammond's ship shows up, and they take it to Earth Omega, where they find the Anti-Monitor's shadow demons. Psycho Pirate has Barry powering some sort of treadmill. Two ships collide above Earth Omega, and a mayday goes out to the Justice Incarnate. While President Superman investigates Luthor's shuttle, Harbinger denies his request. President Superman finds a message from Barry Allen that was hidden, and the JLI decide to go to Earth Omega, and then Machine Head attacks. Machine Head states that years ago, Earth 8 was invaded by an alternate reality. They tried to fight the war in secret, but ultimately lost. Machine Head blames Earth Zero for the loss of his world. Machine Head doesn't want to destroy the multiverse, just keep his world separate. No more crossover between worlds. And Machine Head brings in like-minded members to his team. Injustice.
I don't know about you, Drew, but it seemed like the reveal was that Machine Head was another Hector Hammond. That's what it seemed like he was drawn like.
I don't remember them showing him his face, did they? Did they show us his face? I remember the back of his head.
Right at the end when they reveal the Injustice thing, it's him without his helmet on. I thought that he was supposed to essentially be like Iron Man, and I don't know if they're just trying to draw him like the classic Tony Stark look, but like scarred and stuff. But it's, you know, I mean, it's the dude with the black mustache, and that's normally I would think Hector Hammond, especially since we've already seen him in this story. I don't know if they're just trying to do like a, you know, Tony Stark if he got caught in an explosion or what.
Yeah, I don't know either, but
it seemed like there was a purpose there though, right? Like they focused. Williamson isn't exactly subtle with his writing, and we had that that weird scene where Captain Carrot walks in and he's got the helmet off, but he's his back is faced to him, and Carrot apologizes like this is some terrible thing. Like surely they would have seen him without his helmet. Whatever. But so you get that scene earlier, and then it actually has him without his helmet facing the reader at the end of the issue. So you that felt like it was supposed to be some sort of reveal. But the problem with any comics, honestly, is that it's up to the artist how they draw the face. Like that could be Bruce Wayne for all we know. It's, you know what I mean? Like it works well in like live action stuff because the actor is the actor. We know who that is. But when it's drawn, you don't really know.
You know what that scene reminded me of? The Empire Strikes Back, where Darth Vader has his helmet's off, but you see the back of his head, but it's all scarred and stuff. And one of the officers comes in or something, and the helmet comes back down, and then he turns around, so you don't really see his face. But that's what that scene reminded me of.
Yeah, I agree completely. That's exactly what I thought of. I thought this story has certainly done a better job bringing these threads together. Still not a huge fan of it. It's not bad. It's certainly not bad. But I don't know. I still don't fully know what we're driving at here, other than it just seems like various panicked responses to the existence of the multiverse, which is an interesting – this is the problem, Drew. I feel like it's an interesting idea. It's just not being executed that well because Williamson's just not that good of a writer.
I knew you were going there. One thing I really liked about this issue was the President Superman and Thomas Wayne dynamic. I really enjoyed that in this issue. And honestly, I'd like to see more of that.
One thing I got to say that I know they were trying to go for like a poignant moment and maybe have kind of some catharsis to the conclusion of King's Batman run that we know Williamson had a hand in with the Button crossover. But that scene where he's like looking and he sees that Bruce is still going on as Batman and he's got the Bat family around him. And it's sort of like this, it's supposed to be like this moment, right? Where Thomas realizes, oh, you are Batman. And I was like, what? This is just happening now? You've had how long? And it only occurred to you because somebody else mentioned, you know, a legend of a hero. And he's like, oh, Bruce, maybe I should look him up. Come on, man.
I'm not going to argue with you on that. I thought that was kind of dumb myself.
Again, it's one of those things. I got what Williamson was trying to get at. And that idea was a good idea. He just... Not there, not in the way that he did it. That's the thing that gets me, where it's like, he's clearly got some good ideas going on. It's just the execution. I'm not sure it can really get much better.
I also got the impression that Bones is a villain or he's part of this injustice. They didn't come out and tell us, but that's the indication I got. All right, well, that wraps up our comic books talk for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk our DC television shows.
Welcome to Dr. Geek's Laboratory.
Dr. Geek here with another reminder that the ESO Network is pro-science and pro-vaccine. We urge you to be a superhero and protect yourself, your family, and your fellow geeks around the world. Don't be fooled by the forces of evil and their anti-science misinformation campaign. Consult the latest CDC guidelines, your doctor, and get the COVID vaccine today.
And we're back. Let's talk Superman and Lois, Season 1, Episode 14, The Eradicator. After a month, the DOD is still in Smallville, and the townsfolk are not happy about it. The Cushings are trying to sell their home and move. We see that Kyle gets offered a job as a fire chief 2 hours away. Jordan and Sarah are getting more serious with their relationship. And we also see that Jonathan is spending more time helping John Henry build weapons. Chrissy is going to have to sell the Smallville Gazette to keep from going under. Morgan Edge becomes the Eradicator. He brings Leslie Lahr out of her DOD cell and attacks Metropolis. Superman and John Henry battle the Kryptonians created by the Eradicator. Lois lets the world know that what Morgan Edge is up to via GBS Media News. John Henry saves Lois from being killed like on his world using his hammer. Edge escapes and goes to Smallville, where he wrecks Sam Lane's vehicle with Sam, Jonathan, Jordan, and Sarah all inside. Jordan tells Sarah he loves her as Edge takes him prisoner, and Edge uses his power to have his father possess Jordan's body. One thing I thought was weird in this episode, they talked about how Jonathan had been spending time with John Henry, but the scene we get where they're actually together, John Henry's being a dick.
Yeah, they didn't really have any camaraderie at all that you would... Like, I could see, you know, Jonathan kind of hanging around more than he wants. You know, like, being, like, kind of unaware that, you know, John doesn't want him there all the time. But, I mean, there was, like, no camaraderie there at all.
No, it felt very weird. I was like, if he'd been spending more time with him and they, you know, starting to form some sort of friendship or whatever, or mentorship or whatever... They did not show it here. They did not do a good job of it at all. I did not like this scene.
I'm interested in what they're doing with sort of their version of the Eradicator. I'm curious to see what it's going to look like in the final episode, because they have the guy kind of like powering up at the sun. I don't know that that fully explained anything to me ultimately, Drew. Like, why? I didn't totally get the need for that.
I didn't understand
like,
that
it
either.
It looks cool. I don't know. Was that just it? Like, it looked cool? That's fair. It didn't totally make sense.
It didn't make sense to me either. I was expecting him to charge up and transform. He didn't really transform. So, I didn't get that either. It looked cool, like you said, but other than that, I don't understand what the purpose of it was. I did love the scene where, you know, Lois is telling everybody what is going on. And we find out this is the exact same thing that happened on John Henry's Earth, but this time he's able to save her, and he uses his hammer to do it. I thought that was awesome.
Yeah, I got what they were trying to do with the they were trying to do all the parallels to the attack we had seen on John Henry Irons' Earth. I didn't really feel the stakes. I thought it was cool the way the hammer kind of thwarted what should have been her death, but I also didn't believe that anything other than that was going to happen. It's tough. I don't know. I don't know that the show deserves criticism for that, because, I mean, that's sort of the downside of a CW show, is that, like, that actress ain't going anywhere. So...
That's very true, like, yeah.
It's tough because I don't know what they could have done to have made there feel like there was a real chance of her dying there. I don't know if there was anything they could have done. Like I said, I appreciated what they were, obviously the clear parallels that they were trying to draw there, but I didn't really feel the stakes, but I also don't know that there was anything they could have done to have made that happen.
Yeah, I don't think there would have been. I mean, when I saw the scene, I knew Lois wasn't going to die, but I was also like, how's she going to get out of that? And when the hammer came flying, I was like, oh, okay. And now that Jordan's under Edge's father's possession, I'm kind of curious what they're going to do now. Are they going to get Jordan back right away? Is he going to stay like that for a while? I'm curious about that. I know we've got the season finale coming up next week, so.
I mean, I don't think anything's going to happen to Jordan beyond this episode. I could be wrong. I could be eating my words, but I'd be rather surprised if that carried into next season.
You're probably right. They probably will wrap it up. But you said, I remember you saying at one point, it's possible that you could see maybe Jordan becoming a villain. And, you know, it'd be Jonathan versus Jordan.
Reverse. I felt like they were hinting towards Jonathan becoming like a embittered because Jordan gets the powers. Jordan was getting all the breaks. And I was like, are they trying to create a villain out of Jonathan here?
Oh, I got them mixed up.
I mean, yeah, I get the two names mixed. Like, I'm always picturing the right guy, but I'm not necessarily saying the right names. But yeah, Jonathan, the one without powers, was the one that it felt like for a large part of the season, like they were going out of their way to ensure that he became a bad guy.
That it's confusing because we know that Jonathan Kent in the comic books is Superboy, so that,
right.
It's easy to get him confused.
Yeah. Yes, that's the thing that trips me up, honestly, because Jonathan is, I guess, now Superman, but Superboy, I always assume that it's him. I'm like, nope, it's Jordan. And to make it more confusing, the actor that plays Jonathan is named Jordan.
I know. I'm sure that gets confusing on set. Well, I know it gets confusing on set because I don't know if you had a chance to listen to the 42 cast where he interviews the actor that plays Jordan Kent. He said that does get kind of confusing on set.
I haven't gotten a chance to listen to that yet, but I definitely intend to check it out.
All right, well, let's move on to our next show for this week, Stargirl, Season 2, Episode 1, Summer School, Chapter 1. The episode opens up in Melody Hills, Indiana, decades ago. Rebecca wants to go to a birthday party, but can't because she made a scene at the store and is grounded. A boy named Bruce introduces himself and states he just moved in. Bruce talks to Rebecca into going to the party because her mom isn't watching. And when she gets across the street, Bruce talks her into stealing one of the presents. Rebecca opens it up, and a creepy doll with glowing eyes is inside. Rebecca drops it, and then when she looks down at it, it's totally different. It's a brand new. Bruce suddenly tells Rebecca she's a bad girl for stealing. Then he holds up the Eclipso diamond. A few minutes later, Rebecca's mother goes looking for her and finds her on the ground. They don't show it to us, so she's possibly dead. I gotta tell you, Cletus, I love this opening. It was very creepy in it. It had horror movie vibes to it. It felt weird for a Stargirl show to open up this way, but I liked it. Now, in the present, Stargirl is obsessed with trying to find a villain to stop. She wants the JSA to do unnecessary patrols, and Pat catches her staying up till 4 in the morning on a school night going over villain files in the basement. We see Pat is very excited for a family trip to Yellowstone National Park. Pat asks his friend Zeke to help with fixing up some cars while he's gone. Instead, Zeke finds the robot and is anxious to help Pat tinker with it by adding a flamethrower. Beth is working hard on trying to restore the Dr. McNider AI, but she can't get it to work. After giving her parents breakfast to take with them, Beth comes across divorce paperwork. Yolanda is going to confession, but she's just sitting there. She's having PTSD about killing Brainwave last season. During lunch, Courtney takes down a fellow student because she thinks she's going to whack her in the head with a hockey stick. She was just giving the hockey stick back to her friend. Courtney has a talk with the principal and her parents. She's failed some of her classes and will have to go to summer school if she wants to continue on to her junior year. Rick suspects Solomon Grundy is living in the woods near Blue Valley and is probably the one who's been breaking into restaurants and stealing food. Rick leaves 3 buckets of chicken for him in the woods. Cameron, Brainwave's son, is back in Blue Valley. He's painting a mural and seems happy to see Courtney. Cameron's grandparents seem less than thrilled to see Courtney talking to him. Courtney hears glass breaking and thinks someone is breaking into her house. Courtney fights a girl with a green power ring and a lantern. It's Green Lantern's daughter. At the end of the episode, we see that Cindy Berman enters the school and goes through the secret locker entrance to the Injustice League headquarters. She has the Eclipso Diamond and says she's putting together a new supervillain team.
One of the members apparently being at least intending to be Courtney's brother, which was interesting.
I think I missed that. I don't remember.
It's the last picture she pulls out.
Oh, yeah, because she's looking at files. I forgot. I was like, I don't remember seeing him there. It was the file. I remember that now. That is kind of interesting. I wonder, does he have some sort of latent power she knows about or something?
I don't know necessarily that he has any powers. I think it's more of an intention of using the... My assumption was that she would be using the Eclipso Diamond to corrupt him into being a villain, not that he had any, you know, as like a specific way to needle Courtney, not because of anything he was actually bringing to the table.
Now, talking about the Eclipso Diamond, I want to go back to the opening scene. She does something, the Bruce boy does something to that girl, but we don't see what it is. I was curious, did he trap her inside the diamond, but the mother found the body or something laying there. I'm just wondering what happened to her, or does she look different or something? I don't know if they're going to tell us more in the next episode about that flashback scene or not. I'm just very curious what happened.
I just think she was murdered. Not to be a pessimistic, but I think Eclipso just murdered her. That's kind of what I gathered. So I don't know that they're going to. So I mean, it's one of those things where it's pretty dark, obviously, right? Killing a kid. And so, especially for a CW show. And so I think that's just the way they do it, is to clearly show that it's about to happen and then show the mom reacting, but not show any of the actual violence.
Yeah, that could very well be. I just wish they would have made it a little more clear.
I don't know. I feel like that's about... I see what you're saying, Drew. I don't know on a CW show that you can murder a kid and be more clear than what they did. You know what I mean? Like, that just seems like such a relative taboo for the audience that they're shooting for. I don't know. One thing that was very encouraging, because I was very openly nervous about this, was whether this would look more like the rest of the CW shows, and it thankfully, thank God, it didn't. It still felt like Stargirl. So that was honestly a huge relief for me, because I was really, that was one of the things I was concerned about, what the transition from the DC app to CW would look like. One thing I will say with this episode, I enjoyed it overall, and it felt consistent with what we got a lot in season one. And Drew, I'm going to say it feels consistent with what we've been getting a lot of from Johns in his writing recently too, which is he's just setting up and setting up and setting up. And I'm like, at some point, dude, just tell the story that's happening in the present. I know I don't want to criticize too much because it's the first episode, and that's sort of the job of a first episode, is to sort of set the groundwork for the season. But there was just so much. It was like it was setting up Our man is clearly looking after Grundy. I don't know why they're playing that like a mystery. Like, obviously it's Grundy. I don't know why they're like, oh, it could be Bigfoot. It's obviously Grundy. They're setting that up. They're setting, I'm Green Lantern's daughter, not Alan Scott's daughter. Okay. You know, I don't know. It felt like there was a lot of like individual 10 minute things that were kind of put together that all made sense within the same time span, but they were all just sort of like, it's just so obsessed with like keeping you like, oh, what's going to happen? You know, this thing could happen and this thing could happen and this thing could happen, but it never actually like sits down, relaxes for a second and just lets things happen.
One of the things that surprised me was Jade was actually using a lantern ring and a lantern, because I've always known her to not have to have a ring and stuff to use her abilities.
One thing I will say I noticed is that she was wearing a ring in Infinite Frontier, because I thought the same thing, Drew. I was like, I thought she didn't usually use a ring. And then I noticed that she was using one in Infinite Frontier. I don't know if that's a coincidence or not.
Huh. I'm going to have to go back and look at that, because I didn't notice that.
It makes sense for the show. I mean, I think they could get to a point where they go. I feel like we're probably not going to get green skin Jade.
Yeah, probably not.
Probably not. I could see them getting to a point where she's like kind of her own power battery. I feel like that's what she is in the comics. I have to admit, I don't feel like I have a great grasp of Jade as a character, because she was kind of pushed to the wayside during the Johns run, which is my main Green Lantern reading. So I could see them, you know, transitioning that, but for the show, it kind of makes sense for her to be more of what we think of with Green Lantern, using a ring and the lantern.
Yeah, I was thinking back. The last time I remember Jade being in anything was when she was dating Kyle when he was Green Lantern. And I can't remember anything else she's been in besides being in an Infinite Frontier. So,
I mean, she's been off the table for a while. I think I don't know if she was even used in the New 52. If she was, it had to have been like one obscure use of that character. But she was off the table for a significant portion of time.
Yeah, they could have simply revamped her. So,
and that's a character like I get. Like, that's one where I totally get them revamping for the show, because that. The likelihood of us getting the, you know, green skin Jade is, I think, quite low.
Yeah, that'll be a lot of time and makeup.
But anyway, like I said, like I am interested in all the different things that they're setting up. I'm just worried that, and I felt like the show last season was like this a lot of the time too, where it was seemed more concerned with what was going to happen next episode than it was with just letting things happen within an episode.
So we'll just have to see how episode 2 goes. All right, let's move on to our next show for this week. DC's Legends Tomorrow, Season 6, Episode 11, The Final Frame. Kansas City, 2021. Mick, Sarah, Astra, and Spooner find some sort of alien Rubik's Cube that transports them to a bowling alley. They must beat the purple shirt bowlers if they want to leave. Nick and Flannel Zari are going camping to spend some time alone together. When they decide to find a better camping place, they discover it's the end of the world. Bayrod is making brownies while John's playing with his magic. Ava and Gary are trying to find her the perfect wedding dress. When they haven't heard back from Sarah in a while, they decide to go find them. When Gideon goes to plot a course for Earth, she can't locate it. The Legends learn that they are bowling to save the planet Earth. Nick and Zari are trapped inside the bowling ball. They find one of the finger holes and burn one of the purple bowler's fingers, causing him to get a gutter ball. We see that Sarah's team wins and Earth is saved. I found this episode hilarious. A bowling alley in space.
This is great. I mean, this is exactly what you want out of a Legends episode, like a ridiculous premise. Just, you know, the team getting up to wacky shenanigans, the Earth becoming a bowling ball. I mean, it's great. I mean, this is like a textbook phenomenal Legends episode.
It was, and I had fun watching it.
there were so many moments that were just hilarious. He's polishing the ball was just killing me. Gosh, Drew, what a good episode.
It sure was. All right, let's get on to our last episode for this week. Sweet Tooth, Season 1, Episode 6, Stranger Danger on a Train. Gus, Bear, and Jeopard hop on a train to Colorado. When a man discovers the stowaways, Jeopard fights him until he realizes it's an old football buddy. Gus loses his stuffed animal dog and goes looking for it. When Jeopard and Bear realize Sweet Tooth has run off searching for dog, they go looking for him. Bear realizes there are last men on the train and they are searching through the cars. Jeopard spots the dog, but it's in the same car with the last men. Jeopard puts on a disguise to get the dog, but it doesn't work. The last men realize he's Jeopard. Jeopard's friend Jimmy holds off the last men while Gus, Bear, and Jeopard jump off the train. The trio are happy to learn that they are in Colorado and not too far from where they're going. The general finds what he is looking for at Dr. Singh's house. The notebook. Dr. Singh and his wife bluff that Dr. Singh has the answer to the cure that's not in the notebook. The general takes them as hostages to a new location where they'll be able to work on the cure. At the preserve, we see that it's been marked by the last men, and Amy has Wendy and the other hybrids go into hiding.
Drew, I continue to be very, very curious about the setting, time-wise, of the preserve scenes that we're getting. How contemporary to the action that we're getting is it? Very interesting stuff.
Yeah.
And again, also, I think the doctor is contemporary with what's happening with Sweet Tooth, but I'm not sure that that's the case with that one either. I'm very curious to see these stories come together at some point, whether that's this season or not, because I'm curious when some of these things are happening.
Yeah, same with me. I'm wondering that too. And I'm looking forward to the time when things do come together. So I'm really been enjoying this series. We only got two more episodes left.
It's been such an entertaining show. I'm thrilled that it's getting a second season because it is so clearly whatever. I don't know how it's going to end, Drew, but you know it wouldn't have been enough if it had only gotten one season.
Oh, yeah, definitely. All right, well, that wraps up our show for this week. Do you have a shout-out, Cletus?
Yeah, so we were, talking about how the Superman and Lois have introduced their take on the Eradicator. So, and I was curious, Drew, I imagine you have this issue. He first appeared in Action Comics Annual Number 2 in 1989.
I possibly have that issue. Who'd you say it was?
The Eradicator.
Oh, the Eradicator. I bet I do have that issue.
It's right in your wheelhouse.
Yes, it's during the time when I was collecting comics, so I bet you I do have it. And because the first time I remember the Eradicator showing up was during the Return of the Superman storyline. Well, wait a minute. He might have showed up before then. It's very possible I have that issue. I'd have to go through my Superman comics and see if I can find it. I may look up the cover just to see what it looks like. I could probably tell you. Sometimes just looking at the cover, I'll be like, oh yeah, I have that one.
It's got, I think, Ultra Humanite in the background is what this cover looks like up in the sky. And then some like barbarian looking dude in the front, in the foreground. It honestly doesn't, and nothing about it screams Superman, but it's Action Comics. So
yeah, I'll have to take a look at it and see. All right, and for my shout-out, I'm going to shout-out about Lick It Man, created by Camille Corita and art by Joe Quinones. Now, Joe Quinones is the one that drew Batman number 89 this week. All across the globe, women face the task of juggling career, family, and lovers. But wait, The world's most sensitive superhero has come to liberate women from their overburdened existence. A radioactive lollipop turns Beaver Sparker into Licket Man, a superhero whose compassion and extraordinary talent liberates the women population by providing them with an enlightened orgasm, one that spurs them on to great feats and accomplishments. After Licket Man liberates the female president of the United States that results in world peace, Stickit Man and his sidekick, the Poker, kidnap reporter B.J. Moorhead, and it's up to Licket Man to save the day. I saw this graphic novel, and I was like, I gotta check this out. It was freaking hilarious.
Sounds like a true masterpiece of comics.
It was freaking funny. So, yeah, that's my shout out this week. All right, if you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about this week, you can reach us at our feedback line, 317-564-9133. Leave us a message, or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus, coming up next week, we've got Batman Catwoman, Blue and Gold, Supergirl, Woman of Tomorrow, Superman and the Authority, Superman Red and Blue, Shazam, Batman Secret Files, Clown Hunter, Catwoman, Nightwing, The Flash, and our DC television show, Superman and Lois, and that's the season finale, Stargirl, DC Legends Tomorrow, and Sweet Tooth. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
You're ready to move out.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.